Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Be careful what you wish for. Once, TVE covered the whole world in only 3 half-hour bulletins, and people dreamed of all news channels. Once, a few rich folks, think Luce, Graham, Sulzberger, Paley, owned most of the media, and people dreamed of news without gatekeepers. And here we are. All news channels all over, a billowing, unfillable cloud we call the Internet, with its mashup of reporting and rumor, perspective and paranoia, and maybe straight-up propaganda. Last week, it all hit the fan. This hour, On Point, charges of propaganda in the news and what's happening to the quality of our national information flow. We will hear in this hour from Charles Madigan and from American Conservative Union President David Keene. And we'll get a last word from the late, great Daniel Schorr on getting journalism right. But first, we look at what may be wrong. And we start with E.J. Dionne in Washington, syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. On Monday, the Washington Post published a column of his titled Enough Right-Wing Propaganda, which gives you a pretty good sense of where he thinks the problem lies. E.J. Dionne, welcome. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be with you always, Tom.
Your gloves are really off here on Monday, E.J. What are you saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that the Sherrod case ought to be the end of the line for a dominance, really, of the national conversation by the right wing. And what I'm really talking about here is not that conservative arguments shouldn't get covered, or for that matter, that Fox News has no right to exist. We're a free country. They have a right to exist. But what we've seen over a period of years is the injection of straight-out lies and untruths into the national conversation, and they are dealt with often by a mainstream media so afraid of being called liberal that they can't say, they won't say outright, no, that's just not true. Listeners could be forgiven for not knowing that Al Gore never actually said he invented the Internet. There were no death panels in the health care bill. But when you saw the media deal with death panels, I have in front of me an old ABC story. Mm-hmm. But the president contends the provision is voluntary and no one will force seniors to make choices based on costs. It's not that he contends that there's no provision in there. There is no provision in there. I can contend that I am 6'9 and played for the Boston Celtics, but it wouldn't be true. And we really have to go back to the distinction between what's true and what's not.
And you're saying it's just not being called out here. Of course, you know, and we'll hear this from David Keene with the American Conservative Union. Conservatives say, hey, this cuts both ways. You sort of popped your cork on this, EJ, after last week's Shirley Sherrod, fiasco. Look at that for a minute with us. How do you see what happened there?
Well, I think that, first of all, the administration behaved shamefully. There's no other way to say it. And I think they were way too sensitive this fear they had that Fox News or some other right-wingers were going to control the dialogue. So they fired her before even checking the story out. President Obama complained rightly. He said that Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack jumped the gun, partly because we now live in this media culture where something goes up on YouTube or a blog and everybody scrambles. But it's his own apparatus that turned that media culture into a false god. But you also can't forget that it wasn't Obama's people who took Shirley Sherrod's really moving attack on racism and turned it into, by just clipping sections out, turned it into a proof, which it was a lie, but proof that she was a black racist. That's appalling.
You call Andrew Breitbart, who's biggovernment.com, put that out early last week, a hitman. But he's in
a right-wing hitman. I do not mean in that in the 1920s sense or an Al Capone sense. I mean that as somebody who picks left targets. He said himself he wanted to go after the NAACP because the NAACP actually made a very careful statement about the Tea Party. Again, that got distorted, too. They didn't say the Tea Party is is racist. They said very carefully there are some elements of the Tea Party that are racist, and we call on the non-racist elements of the Tea Party to call them out. But that was too much for Breitbart, and so he went after this innocent woman in order to go after the NAACP.
And it got picked up quite vividly and in a big, big hurry. Here's a little montage of Fox News commentary on Shirley Sherrod. This is from right at the get-go last week with Bill O'Reilly. You'll hear here Newt Gingrich and Allison Camerota of Fox and Friends.
Ms. Sherry must resign immediately.
Firing her after that kind of viciously racist attitude was exactly the right thing to do.
Perhaps everybody needs a refresher course on what racism looks like. I mean, that is
Exhibit A.
Exhibit A.
Exhibit A of racism, except, EJ, it turns out when you hear the whole speech, it wasn't.
No, and that's exactly right. And you saw Fox ready to jump on this excerpt without doing any checking, which is why I think we should question whether the word news ought to be in the title of that network. It's to CNN's credit. And here is one, I think, good news story about the old mainstream media, which is Shirley Sherrod moved very quickly to say, wait a minute, that's not what I said if you listen to the whole speech. And CNN was out there at 10 o'clock that night with a family, the white family she allegedly discriminated against, actually say, no, she helped us save our farm. And they had the rest of the tape. So in this case, the mainstream media did fortunately move pretty quickly to say, hold on, this just isn't true.
But the message that Andrew Breitbart quite deliberately, I think, was looking to put out there was out there. By the end of the week, here was Shirley Sherrod talking with CNN's John King about what she thought at that point of conservative blogger Andrew Breitbart when he defended what he had posted about her on his website.
I tell him he's a lie. He knew exactly what effect that would have on not only, he knew what effect that would have on the conservative, racist people he's dealing with. That's why I started getting the hate mail. And that's why I started getting the hate calls. He got the effect he was looking for.
He got the effect he was looking for, said Shirley Sherrod late last week. EJ, you call this propaganda. It may live right in the middle of our media, our news media. Who knows what even to call it these days, but you call it propaganda.
Right. And you know what? We got to be clear on propaganda. There's truthful propaganda. I mean, everybody's entitled to try to propagate their views. David Keene's going to come on. He has a conservative view of the world. David and I have known each other for a long time, and we've argued about politics. But what we're having increasingly is lying propaganda or untrue propaganda, where take the swift boating of John Kerry. You go back to those stories and, well, these men served with John Kerry. None of them served with John Kerry. They were in Vietnam at the same time as John Kerry was, but they weren't on those swift boats with him. And so we have gotten into a media climate. And again, I think it's real timidity on the part of the mainstream media because they're so much more afraid of being called liberal than being called anything else. And so I think they give the right more leeway than they give the left. I mean, I'm prepared to acknowledge, by the way, that I do think that if you are a social conservative, say on an issue like abortion, you probably don't get as fair a shake in the media as you should. On the other hand, if you are an economic liberal, particularly on issues like trade or support for labor unions, on those issues, the mainstream media tends to give the left a hard time. But I think overall, they're more afraid of the right, and so they bend over backwards for the right. And I think that has negative impact when it comes to calling out whether things are true or untrue.
There are a lot of stories out there, though, that are pumped one way or the other. And on the right, Fox News, for example, has been looking at the new Black Panther Party story and really making a lot of it on the air. They say, look, we're pointing to something important that needs to be addressed and is being kind of hushed up. You say no. You put the propaganda tag on that as well. Why?
Well, Abigail Thernstrom, whom some of your listeners probably know, is an academic, a very smart conservative appointed to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights by George W. Bush. No liberal, Abigail Thernstrom. And she told Politico's Ben Smith, this doesn't have to do with the Black Panthers. This has to do with their, meaning conservative members of the commission, their fantasies about how they could use this issue to topple the Obama administration. And one of the gentlemen pushing this, who worked in the Bush Justice Department, he's a Republican activist going back to the Bill Clinton years. He was a poll watcher for Bush in Florida. And he says, this case proves the Justice Department is motivated, I'm quoting him, by a lawless hostility toward equal enforcement of the law. What evidence does he have for that? There is no evidence. That is a racially inflammatory, politically motivated charge, and it's nonsense. And if you look at the videos of what these folks were doing, they did settle the case. They had, you know, they did eventually settle the case. They've released 4,000 pages of documents. I think the right just wants to keep pumping this up because they're pushing a line that the Obama administration treats blacks differently from the way it treats whites. And again, I just think that's flatly untrue. If you're going to make an explosive charge like that, you got to have lots and lots of proof, and they don't have it.
EJ, you say we're in a news environment, in a media environment, where liars win.
Well, not always. And that's, again, the good news about the Breitbart case. And the other thing, the Shirley Sherrod case, is because she moved so quickly, because CNN and then other media moved so quickly, fortunately, this one was beaten back pretty fast. And on some of these other stories, I think the problem is eventually the truth wins out. Eventually, for example, people, I think, realized that there were no death panels in this health care bill. In fact, unfortunately, they took out a perfectly good provision that would have helped people get counseling on end-of-life issues. But it takes too long to get to the truth.
Here's a little bit more. This was compiled by Media Matters, a montage of Fox News early reporting on the Shirley Sherrod story. Have a listen.
Shirley Sherrod was asked to give a speech. She's a USDA official. And from there on in, it kind of went bad.
There's an official from Barack Obama's United States Department of Agriculture making a speech to the NAACP that sure sounded racist.
Just the latest in a series of racial incidents. What do you think of this?
So she admits there that because a farmer was white, she doesn't extend the full helping hand to him. And she's touting this in this anecdote as though this is a feather in her cap somehow for her to be congratulated.
Of course, Shirley Sherrod's big message was exactly the opposite of that. It was a message against racism that eventually came up. But boy, what a storm in the meantime. Here's Keith Olbermann on MSNBC last week going after Fox News.
What you see on Fox News, what you read on right-wing websites, is the utter and complete perversion of journalism. And it can have no place in a civilized society. It is words crashed together, never to inform, only to inflame. It is a political guillotine. It is the manipulation of reality to make the racist seem benevolent and to convict the benevolent as racist, even if her words must be edited, filleted, stripped of all context, rearranged, fabricated, and falsified to do so. What you see on Fox News, what you read on right-wing websites, is a manipulation, not just of a story, not just on behalf of a political philosophy, manipulation of a society. It's intentional redirection from reality and progress to a paranoid delusion and the fomenting of hatred of Americans by Americans.
Okay, there's MSNBC's Keith Olbermann. On the right, some were saying don't back down here. Here was Rush Limbaugh. He went after Fox News for backing off of their early take on the Shirley Sherrod story.
Even Fox caved on this. Even Shep Smith, even poor old Shep Smith went down there and said that everybody's wrong on this, that Breitbart is wrong and so forth. There's only a handful of us that have the guts to put this story straight. If we don't hammer back, nobody will. We got a bunch of cowards in the conservative media inside the Beltway, which will not deal with this honestly. You got Andy McCarthy, you got Mark Levin, Sean Hannity, you got me, you got Brent Bozell, and that's about it, that are dealing with this up front and honest.
Cowards in the conservative media, said Rush Limbaugh right there. E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post is with us. David Keene now joins us from Washington as well, president of the American Conservative Union, the nation's oldest and largest grassroots conservative lobbying organization. David Keene, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. You say E.J. has come out with a, you know, sort of pretty firm interpretation of what's going on here, David, and he lays it at the feet of the right. What do you say?
Well, that's what E.J. would do. We've been friends for a long time, and he was once a pretty good reporter. Now he's in the business, I guess, of what he would call truthful propaganda, which he described during the remarks that he made. He's not, as usual, entirely wrong, but the picture he paints is very different from the reality. First of all, let me hit for just a moment on the whole Breitbart episode. The immediate conclusion of liberals was that Andrew Breitbart took this, edited it, as Keith Olbermann, who's a paragon of morality in this area, said, filleted it, changed it, changed the words around, and then put it out for a racist purpose. Fox News has been described since as a racist network. Fact of the matter is, if there's no evidence that this happened at all. Breitbart said he put up what he had. If he made a mistake at the outset, it was the mistake that because of the pressure, because of biases, because of a lot of things in today's journalism, a lot of journalists make, and that is he didn't take the next step. I was interested and struck by a conversation on Fox News between Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck. O'Reilly, of course, when he realized that he'd made a mistake, admitted that he made a mistake, but he said to Beck, you know, you're smarter than I am because you didn't use it. You refused to use it. And Beck said, no, I'm not smarter than you are, Bill. I'm just more paranoid. When a source gives me something that looks like it's too good to be true, it usually isn't. And so I'm very careful about checking it. Now, it would be a great world in which everybody checks, but I think all of us in recent years have been stung by the new media, if you will, and the pressures and the technology that exists today. EJ and I have been friends for a long time, and he knows that I spent about 30 years in national political campaigns and the like. And I have to say that during that time, no national reporter that I dealt with, whether I agreed with him or disagreed with him or her, ever burned me. These were professionals at the top of their profession. They knew that the relationship between those they cover and them is essentially one in which everybody has to cooperate and follow the truth. The danger in those years always was from the local reporter, the second-tier reporter, somebody who was on the make, somebody who would do anything to get to the next step. What technology and the new media has created, along with this 24-hour news cycle that really has a 10-minute deadline, is 100,000 hungry people who want to move forward in competitive pressures to get things out without checking them.
But this is the health of the republic we're talking about.
I'm not getting to that point. I'll mm-hmm. get to that in a second, mm-hmm. Tom. But that's part of what's going on. Now, there are biased people. One of the things that really offends me is it seems to me that the last refuge of a cornered liberal is to claim that everyone who disagrees with his position is a racist. You mentioned this whole journalist thing, the thing that the Daily Caller came forward, an E-list or an E-community of some 400 liberal journalists and academics that's now defunct, but which was set up by one of EJ's colleagues at the Washington Post.
Now a colleague.
Now, I don't think, mm-hmm. pardon me?
Now a colleague, not one Ezra Klein said.
Okay.
It, but anyway, yeah.
They set this up, and I'm not claiming that they marched in lockstep. They didn't. It was a discussion group where they talked about their concerns and about what they thought was legitimate and what wasn't. Now, at one point, because they were mostly partisans of Barack Obama and because they were very upset about the Jeremy Wright coverage, including on the mainstream media, one of their number, not an important journalist, but one of their numbers suggested that what they ought to do is change the subject. And the way to change the subject would be to pick somebody out, as he put it, it didn't matter who, and label him and call him a racist, because that would change the subject. Now, what struck me was not that everybody did that, though some did. What struck me was that there wasn't much pushback. I can tell you that if there was a group of conservative journalists or whatever who got together and somebody said, let's go pick somebody out and call him gay, that'll change the subject, the roof would blow up.
David King,
because
hold
that's unacceptable
right there.
From a professional ethical standpoint.
Yeah, David King, hold it right there. EJ, come in here, and maybe first to this issue of Andrew Breitbart and his intentions. David King is more generous than you in his interpretation of what happened with Breitbart. He said, look, he got this thing, he turned it around quick, out it went, it's a matter of time. You're describing something different. You're saying, no, this was deliberate. This was deliberately put out there as a fragment of propaganda. What about it, EJ?
Breitbart had had this for a long time. He didn't just get it and put it out. Number two,
Andrew Breitbart. He didn't have the whole speech, EJ.
No, but he had this fragment. And
he knew it was
Paul
potent.
Andrew Breitbart, that. A journalist. If Andrew Breitbart is a journalist, I'll go back. Then I am a 6'9" NBA star. He's not a journalist in any way, shape, or form. And he's been very explicit. He wanted to put out something damaging to hit back at the NAACP. He was reckless with this. Fox News, from those excerpts you just played, was absolutely reckless with this. CNN, which was on the air sort of contemporaneously or just a little while later, didn't just run with this story. They actually went to her. They found this family. She put them in touch with this family, and they were able to show what a fraud this thing was in very short order. So you can't sort of turn
Vilsack could have done, in other words.
Well,
I mean, there were a lot of people here who didn't do the kind of due diligence that that you or I might suspect, and all of them, and including your remarks earlier and your reaction to this earlier, EJ, all of them did it because of the time pressures.
They did it because, in the case of the Obama administration, because they were fearful that the right wing was really going to run with this. There was a report that they were worried how it would play on Glenn Beck. Ironically, because Beck went on later, he was able to say, gee, they shouldn't have fired her. So it was this fear of the right wing
media. He didn't do what
he
said he did. And EJ, you know, part of the problem is putting yourself in the minds of other people. You happen to know what went through Glenn Beck's mind as you know what went through Andrew Breitbart's mind. I'm not saying that at all.
I'm going on what Breitbart said, and all I said about Glenn Beck is if the Obama administration was worried about what he'd do with it, they ended up putting Glenn Beck in a better position because he didn't go with it and then later said they made a mistake. So what I am saying is that there is this enormous fear now of the right-wing media that distorts the mainstream media and clearly in this case distorted the decision-making of the Obama administration. Journalist point, nobody, there was one member of that group who said, let's call somebody a racist, and they named a couple of names.
I'm not saying everybody said that, EJ. Wait a minute. I'm not saying everybody said that. There were 400 people who got that.
Right, but you said some did. Nobody did.
Where was the outrage? It seems to me that it was an arguably acceptable point to make. And I would expect that professionals who were in a group where somebody suggested that would rise up en masse and say, you are unacceptable. These are not the kinds of things that we do. That did not happen.
But that was also a private listserv. I mean, David Keene, you've got conservatives, even like David Frum, talking about the shame of the conservative media here, saying, you know, conservatives are consumed with news snippets out of context, saying, you know, the conservatives have, these days I guess he means, a unique capacity to ignore unwelcome fact. Others are saying there's a kind of, whatever it takes, to get at the Obama administration. You're a conservative. I mean, what about this issue?
Tom, the health of
the republic, the conversation of this country, how do we keep it straight enough that sensible conservative people, if you will, can listen, pay attention, and make good decisions, respond in the way that democracy requires?
Sure. I know liberals that find Keith Olbermann obnoxious as well. And I think there is a difference. But first, EJ, if this were 1960 with a deadline, with a news cycle that didn't take place immediately, the White House could have checked. That was my point about time pressure. What everybody did was react in the moment. What we have now are opinions and journalists who act in the moment, who feel they can't hold anything, partly for competition reasons, partly because of the way the technology has changed. As Tom said, we wish for something, we've gotten it.
But EJ's saying it's not time. He's saying it's deliberate. It's deliberate manipulation.
If
I charge that, for example, during the final debate that took place in the Congress on the health care bill, a number of members of Congress orchestrated a march through the demonstrators and then claimed that people threw racial epithets at them and spit at them. No one was able to find anybody that backed that up, and yet a lot of journalists took it as true because it fit their characterization of what those people might be like. Now, was that deliberate on their part? Was that part of a conspiracy? I doubt it.
I don't even know if it's true that it wasn't true. I mean, it's really hard
to know.
I
don't think that the job of a journalist is to say, I'm going to report this because I don't know it isn't true.
People looked
if
at
you're
that.
Gonna
no, but we're living in a world where who knows?
That's why in the old days you'd want more than one source.
Well, who knows
David,
what the
facts
are?
David, I just think you made an assertion that may well be untrue. Journalists looked at that tape over and over again. There is no denying that people jeered. There is no denying
of course
that
it was
they
a
said some awful things. And John Lewis said I was spit at. I think John Lewis has a certain standing where he's not somebody who makes things up. So people reported it because he has built up credibility over a long period of time. There are people on either side of politics that I am more likely to trust than others because they have a track record of not making things up.
I think making
a moral equivalence, by the way, between what MSNBC does and some of the stuff we're talking about here, I think some of that's false. Keith Olbermann goes over the top sometimes. He loves to bait Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh. But I'd love David to produce somewhere in the course of this show something they invented. Their stock in trade is simply to play tape of what Sarah Palin said or some other conservative said. Now, you can say you don't like that kind of partisan journalism, but I'd like
EJ,
to know.
EJ, they play snippets of tape just like everyone else does because of the kind of show that they have.
But is it just like
everyone
else?
It is just like everyone else.
I don't know.
To a different degree.
Mm-hmm.
But let me go back, Tom, to your major point.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways in which the world has changed, and I'm not arguing that this is good or bad. In fact, in many ways, I think it's bad. It's one of the reasons we have the political impasse that we have today. In the 1960s and the 1970s, for good or for ill, as you indicated in the opening of this of the hour, we got our news from one or two sources.
Mm-hmm.
Very much fewer sources. They were pretty much all in agreement about everything. Whether they were right or wrong is not the point. In a sense, in those days, if you talked to liberals, conservatives, Democrats, and Republicans, they all lived on the same planet. They all sort of agreed on what the problems were. They disagreed on the solutions to those problems, but their priorities, partly because this is set by the context of what you see and what you hear and what you read. Today, they live on different planets. Liberals tune into MSNBC, or someplace else. Not that many of them tune in there. Conservatives tune into Fox or somewhere else. Some people go into CNN. And if you take those outlets and look at them and realize that people who watch one as opposed to people who watch the other and don't balance it, are living on different planets.
But different planets shouldn't be a passport to make things up.
I mean, I'm not arguing that it should be, and I'm not saying that anybody should be making anything up, and I'm not acknowledging that anyone does. What I am, and let me just say on the Breitbart thing, there is no evidence that he did the things he was charged with doing.
But he very much
he can be charged.
David. I don't think you want to go down that road because he said a lot of this already out there on the record.
Everybody is talking about this. Mark Halpern in Time Magazine says, all of us who are involved in politics and media should take a moment to recognize we have hit a low point and let all of us resolve that having hit bottom, it is time to start climbing out of the pit. What will that take? Joining us right now from Evanston, Illinois, just up from Chicago there, Charles Madigan is here. He's presidential writer-in-residence at Roosevelt University in Chicago, teaches journalism, politics. For 40 years, he was a reporter, editor, and columnist at the Chicago Tribune, and a correspondent at home and abroad for UPI, author of Destiny Calling. Charles Madigan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you see going on here?
Well, I think that you could have your characters throwing bricks at each other across a gap for the rest of their lives, and they would never agree. But I think if you set a different measure to what you're looking at, it can make a little more sense. And I view what you're seeing as part of a business proposition, not a part of politics, not a part of propaganda, not a part of anything other than the fact that the right has figured out an extremely effective way to generate an amazing amount of income. And all you need to do is look at what's happened to Rush Limbaugh's audience and Glenn Beck's audience and now Andrew Breitbart's emerging audience to realize it's not about journalism. it may well not even be about politics. It's about speaking to that audience.
Well, you can say that. They may make a lot of money and buy a yacht, but it's steering our politics like crazy.
No, it's not. It's basically, to me, it's a situation in which the people who pay attention to politics, which is folks like you, me, your guests, get completely immersed in this. The people who don't pay attention to politics hear it in passing, and that's where the big danger is.
Hear it in passing? Are you kidding me? I mean, millions and millions of people listen to these shows, and then it gets passed on. It becomes the very stuff of our presidential campaigns. Last week, it had the, you know, the Obama administration firing Shirley Sherrod. I mean, if that's not consequential in political terms, what is?
I didn't say it was not consequential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that we end up with a marketplace, an information marketplace that's so fragmented that depending on when you drop in the process, you come away with a different version of reality. And the reason that happens is because we, as journalists, have abandoned completely our responsibility for vetting what we present. And all you need to do is go start looking at how people measure themselves now. Page views, numbers, who's first, who's fastest, those are the things that determine who succeeds now. And that wasn't the case 20 years ago. And I don't want to sound like a geezer talking about journalism here. I mean, I've run websites. I know what that's like. But the fact of it is, when you forfeited the responsibility to get it right first, you left go of the most valuable thing you had.
So you're saying
that's
journalists,
why these things can happen.
Step back, big picture. You're saying journalists are to blame for our problems here with the news float? It's the media?
I think that's part of it. But I also think that you can't use broad descriptions like mainstream media and journalists anymore. There are 1,000 different sources of information. And what they're going to be labeled will be figured out over time, just as in the early 19th century we had pamphleteers and propagandists all over the place publishing whatever they wanted. This process is working itself out.
I've read you saying that the problem is actually, of all things, us, whoever us is. I mean,
sure.
Like the American public, you wrote, the thought that people get the government they deserve also applies to media. People get the media they deserve. What do you
mean?
Absolutely
right.
What do you mean?
If you decide that you're no longer going to pay attention to media in a way that's significant, if you're no longer going to pay for newspapers, if you're no longer going to pay for content, then you're going to diminish the whole process. I think we have a marketplace decision going here that's affecting everything that goes on. And you're looking at the strong players in that marketplace, and they happen to be, I don't know whether you want to call them propagandists or not, but I would call them businessmen. And I think they're very effective at it.
And
they make the most noise, and it does pervert the process in a lot of different ways. But just because somebody serves you a bad meal doesn't mean you have to eat it. You, at any given point, if you're a journalist, you can sit down and say, well, that doesn't sound right. You can give it a smell test and pursue it and come out with something that's closer to the truth, even though you're not first, even though you're not getting all the attention.
What do you make of the
disappearing?
What do you make of the equivalency argument? E.J. Dionne, who's with us here, came out this week, really sort of put his flag down and said, look, this is not, what's going on here is not practiced equally by all sides. He said it's the right and it's propaganda. David Keene says, come on, you've been a journalist for a long time, Charlie. How do you see the
those
equivalent?
Are subjective arguments. You need
are
to
they?
Understand the nature. You
but you're a journalist. It can't just be subjective.
Hey, you need to understand the nature. I'm being more a journalist here than anybody else. I'm standing back as far as I can and looking at it. And what I'm saying
I would dispute that. I've been colleagues for a long time in the last. I'm geezer-like, too.
I'm sorry.
Finish, please?
Yes, please, Charles.
These people who are presenting this information, for whatever purpose, believe it and present it. And if you talk to some conservatives about how they feel about media, they keep bringing up exactly the same points all the time, and they believe this. I don't agree with them. I don't think that we're deliberately liberal.
But if they believe
that we distort things,
that doesn't mean it's true. That doesn't mean it's true. It doesn't mean there's necessarily equivalency. I want to hear from our listeners. Nashville.
We have an entitlement here to say whatever we feel we believe we should say.
It doesn't mean that that's being used in the same way by everybody. It could be, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. Kelly in Nashville, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question and a comment.
Okay.
My question to the panelists are whether bringing back the fairness doctrine would make a difference here.
Equal time for different political views on the air.
Right. Whether that, which fell, by the way, said under the Reagan administration, whether bringing that back would make a better impact. But also, I have a comment that I have to agree with the last speaker that it seems to me that it's only right-wing media and Fox News who present false and misleading information. And I cannot, for the life of me, understand why there's so much timidity in calling them out for it. to me, it's reminiscent of the McCarthy era when most Americans were afraid to stand up to the bullies who fed on people's fear and bigotry.
Kelly, I appreciate your call. Charlie Madigan, first to you. Shades of the McCarthy era or something else?
I don't think so. I think, once again, we have a constitutional right to speak in this country, and you can speak as loudly and as incorrectly as you want to speak. We don't have a constitutional obligation to accept everything, and that's where the problem seems to have its flaws.
EJ, new McCarthyism here?
Yeah, no, I think there is some of that in the sense of people being intimidated. I broadly agree with what the caller said. Just on this, these two things. One is, I write a column, and I think of myself as a journalist. I was a journalist going back to the 1970s. And what does that mean? When you write a column, you're entitled to an opinion. But I am not entitled to invent facts. I fact check what I write very closely. I have other people do it with me. And when I go after somebody, I want to go after them on the facts or because I disagree with them. And I don't think I have any right to do anything but report and express a point of view. Secondly, I think there is a problem. If the mainstream media is going to survive, that is to say, some of the great old institutions that Charlie and I worked for, I think they will survive because they are trusted agents for checking out whether things are true or not, and that David and I and Charlie could all agree, well, broadly speaking, this newspaper, that news outlet tells us things that are true. And what I'm worried about, you know, David said earlier on, we don't live on the same planet. Yes, we do. David is not broadcasting to us from Mars. And we would have a much better debate if we could agree on what the facts are and stick to them and then have an argument about what our values tell us to do about those facts.
Would the fairness doctrine help on that?
No.
I'm mixed on the fairness doctrine. There's part of me that likes it because it was a way of guaranteeing two sides to a story, and people just couldn't buy out all the time on radio or television. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think it's going to happen, especially in this very diverse media marketplace.
It's a third rail on the right. David?
But let me say something about that, because whatever you think about how the fairness doctrine did operate, it was a doctrine for a different day. It was a doctrine, regardless of the motives of the people who put it in, that was felt by a lot of people to be necessary at a time when there were very few outlets, and where if a view was shut out of one or two of them, that view was shut out. Today there are thousands of outlets, and just from the standpoint of what they were trying to accomplish, which was to get exposure for a diversity of ideas, we have exposure for a diversity of ideas. That is not the question that we're addressing here. The question we're addressing here is whether those people, in expressing that diversity of ideas, are doing so as responsibly or are pursuing the kind of ethical activity that we might like or that we might agree with.
And if we're getting the facts on which to build well-founded ideas.
Well, you know, the problem with, and I agree with everything you're saying, the problem is when you start determining these facts are the right facts, and the facts are also in conflict in many cases.
Yes, maybe. No, maybe until you figure them out. But you can't just let make it a muddy pile. I want to get a call.
Let's make something clear here about what's happened. What's happened in the new age we're living in. In my youth, political reporting was not a rare thing, but it wasn't anywhere near as common as it is now, and commentary wasn't anywhere near as common as it is now. It was basically limited to editorial pages in big papers and op-ed pages. And what's happened is that we have created an explosion in political commentary to the point at which it overwhelms everything else that's going on. I could argue with you that 90% of what media does is exactly what media has always done. You can look at the content of newspapers, you can look at the content of wire services, you can look at the content of websites, and you see when the plane crashes in Pakistan, everybody covers that story basically the same way because there's an agreeable set of facts there.
But that's no longer what 90% of the media does. As you say, Charlie, 90% maybe is doing something different now. Ed, in Beverly, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
I don't disagree with you on that.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As an independent-minded person, this issue is of particular interest to me, I guess because I think that the technology right now can disseminate information or misinformation so quickly to so many people. And I guess my question is, And I guess, and the other problem is this entrenched ideology that goes along with that information. But my question to, I guess, Charlie specifically, because to use his analogy, you know, if you get served a bad meal, you don't have to eat it, but where do you get the good meal?
Where do you get the good meal? That's an honest citizen's question. Charles Madigan, where's the good meal today? The honest, straight-up reporting.
That's what journalists are supposed to do.
Yeah,
journalists are supposed to vet things, measure them, present the best version of the truth that they can collect.
What if the media is not doing that? But what if it's not? What if it's not?
Much of the media still is. What's happening is that there's a whole subset of media, and it's becoming very popular, and it's ideological, that doesn't do that anymore. And I view the left and the right as the same in this situation. You don't have to look for a moral equivalency in what they do or say. They're both running marketing machines. Mm. That's what it's about.
E.J. Dionne, Mark Halpern says we've hit bottom here. Time to climb out of the pit. Do you agree we've hit bottom, E.J.?
Well, first of all, I don't think there is moral equivalency here. I think there really is. This habit is now much more entrenched on the right, and I could provide a lot of evidence for that if we had a lot of time, and I've tried to do some in the column.
You've got 10 seconds.
But I am hoping that this Shirley Sherrod thing pushes everybody back. There was some embarrassment, at least in some corners of Fox News. Bill O'Reilly said so. And I hope this makes the mainstream media do a lot more checking. And again, this is a good news story in part because the mainstream media knocked down this story pretty fast.
E.J. Dionne with the Washington Post. Thank you for being with us today, E.J.
Thank you.
Charles Madigan at Roosevelt University in Chicago. Thank you, Charles Madigan, for being here.
Thank you.
And David Keene at the American Conservative Union. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
In a moment, one last word from Daniel Shore on the state of the news. This is On Point. As it seems the whole world knows, NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore died last Friday. Dan was 93. His much-honored career in journalism spanned over 7 decades, from Cold War and Watergate to the Gulf oil spill and last week's headlines. In 2002, Daniel Shore was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, where he delivered a speech on the state of journalism. He later excerpted his comments for broadcast. We share them with you now in a last word from Daniel Shore.
If I'm supposed to represent the world of journalism and communications, this honor may be a big mistake. Over the years, I have developed serious reservations about an industry in which I have worked for more than 6 decades. I do not include National Public Radio, where I have found contentment in my declining years. But having experienced journalism in its print, radio, and television incarnations, I have come to mourn the way my beloved profession has become progressively oriented to entertainment, scandal, and profit. I have become aware of increasing public hostility to an institution supposed to monitor the establishment, but now itself a vast establishment. The public finds the media insensitive and exploitative and is no longer willing to forgive us our trespasses. Sometimes it seems to me that our whole profession is crowded into a small corner of a vast entertainment stage, obliged to borrow the tools and the values of entertainment and live by its standards. From O.J. Simpson to Monica Lewinsky, the media have displayed an inexorable attraction to scandal along with violence and the hot pursuit of celebrities. The Internet has introduced a new dimension of unedited irresponsibility in journalism. Do you remember how the Clinton scandal that led to impeachment first got started? Self-styled gossip monger Matt Drudge posted on the web the rumor that Newsweek was working on some story about the president and his relationship with an intern. In fact, Newsweek was working on a story and holding it for further fact-checking. In these times, the definition of journalist has changed. A journalist can be a talk show host skilled at getting guests to yell at each other. A journalist can be a celebrity who came through the revolving door from government. Occasionally, our news media measure up to their responsibility at a time of national tragedy. Television displayed its capacity to bind Americans into a community at moments like the assassination of John and then Robert Kennedy. It reached new heights on September 11th and then the anniversary of September 11th. I was impressed by television's willingness then to cancel millions of dollars in commercials. But the Ground Zero coverage is the exception. For the rest, I am sad about the state of journalism, a profession I have loved not always wisely, but well.
The late, great NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore on the state of journalism, from a 2002 speech to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Daniel Shore died Friday at 93. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for your thoughts. Thanks for joining us. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.